Welcome to CERT's podcast series, Security for Business Leaders. The CERT program is part of the Software Engineering Institute, a federally funded research and development center at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. You can find out more about us at CERT.org. Show notes for today's conversation are available at the podcast website. My name is Julia Allen. I'm a senior researcher at CERT, working on security governance and software assurance. Today, I'm pleased to welcome Bob Charette, founder of Itabi Corporation and an internationally recognized expert in risk management, information systems and technology, as well as systems engineering. Today, Bob and I will be discussing the merits of a new idea he's kicking around, developing a list of software security never events. Just by way of brief introduction, the healthcare community uses this term to describe life-threatening, serious, and entirely preventable medical errors, but Bob will tell us more. So welcome, Bob. Glad to have you with us today.
Well, thank you, Julia, for having me on today.
Okay, so just to do a little stage setting, can you say a bit about what a never event is from whatever fields of endeavor it comes from and a little bit about how it came to be?
Sure. As you mentioned, the term is one that's been used first in the mid-1990s by the National Quality Forum, which is a nonprofit membership organization that was created to develop and try to implement the national strategy for healthcare quality measurement and reporting. And they wanted a way to describe errors in medical care. So what they did is they developed a list, which has grown to some 28 what they call medical never events. And some of them, to give you an example of a medical event, includes, say, surgery on the wrong part of the body, like removing a kidney when you were really trying to remove a gallbladder, leaving a foreign object like a sponge or scalpel in a patient after surgery, or receiving, say, the wrong dosage of medicine while you're in hospital care. So for something to be considered a never event from a medical standpoint, it must be clearly identifiable and measurable because it has to be able to be reported. It's usually preventable, and it has to be serious enough in their consequence for patients, which means having causing a permanent disability or causing death, which is a fairly serious, or to indicate a real problem in safety or credibility of a healthcare facility. So it also has some elements of process. In other words, the purpose of developing this list of never events was really to try to bring some level of public accountability to medical errors that under most circumstances should not, by any reasonable standard or by looking at it by a reasonable person, really occur. As a result of this list, which is interesting, is that the U.S. government and many insurance companies now have decided that they're not going to pay for certain of these medical never events. Not all 28. There's five or seven that the government won't pay for anymore, and insurance companies won't pay for either.
Well, you know, we're talking about medical, healthcare, life-threatening situations, and that seems kind of far afield from software or software security. So what made you make the connection, and why do you think this might be a useful concept, particularly now?
Well, for a fairly number of years, and you're aware of this because we've had conversations about it, I've been trying to advocate for something similar to medical never events and have some type of list in regard to software, either in terms of development or process, et cetera. Unfortunately, I haven't really been able to make much headway because it was pretty hard to get agreement from my colleagues in either academia or in industry as to what we could really call a software never event. First of all, part of the reason is one of language and terminology. In the medical field, never events are very, very extreme events. They're things that really don't happen at all in any type of major statistical quantity. Whereas in software, we're constantly surrounded, it seems, by problems. So a lot of my friends said we probably should call it in hopes of a software never event, or maybe better, software ever events. And in fact, my friend Martin Thomas, who co-founded the UK software company Praxis and which is a high reliability software company and is a visiting professor at Oxford University Computing Laboratory, wrote me when I was talking to him about this that he was a strong supporter of having some type of initiative where we could eliminate things that shouldn't occur. But as far as he could recall, the software industry has never learned from a mistake and created a never event. So part of it has been some pushback in terms of how do we actually describe these things. But recently, it's come to my attention that a coalition of more than 30 U.S. and international cybersecurity organizations led by MITRE and the SANS Institute and CERT jointly released a consensus list of what they're calling the 25 most dangerous programming errors that lead to security bugs and that are used to allow cybercrime and cyber espionage and cyber warfare. And they're calling this the Top 25 Errors Initiative. And what they say, and I'm going to quote from their press release, is that the impact of these errors is far-reaching. Just two of them led to more than 1.5 million website security breaches during 2008, and those breaches cascaded onto the computers of people who visited those websites, turning their computers into zombies. They also said that most of these errors, most of the 25, are not well understood by programmers. Their avoidance is not widely taught by computer science programs, and their presence is frequently not tested by organizations developing software for sale. So when I looked at that list, I felt that, well, maybe this would be a good time to revisit the idea of never events and to see whether or not, given the increased frequency and severity of IT security incidents, that maybe this would be a good time to start, you know, a new conversation. The idea seemed pretty obvious in retrospect, especially if there's a list of agreed upon errors and ways to prevent them.
So clearly, you know, software is a young science, certainly much younger than the medical profession, software security even more so. So what I hear you saying is you're really taking the concept of something that kind of as ethical, high-integrity practitioners, if we're developing software or acquiring software, that there's just a certain minimum set of things that we should just never do. Is that where you feel the two concepts kind of connect?
Yeah, but I think it's more than that, too. To be honest, I'm a little bit wary now, or weary is probably a better term, of us always continuing to say software is a young science, maybe in comparison to medicine. But, you know, I've been in the field for, I hate to say it, but 37 years when, you know, since the time I was an 18-year-old punch card operator at a university during the summer. And, you know, back then I heard that IT was a young field, and, you know, here it is 37 years later, and I keep hearing that same argument. I think that it's not only in high reliability areas. I think that a lot of the errors that were on the list are ones that have been around for a long time that we know really shouldn't occur in software anymore. And I think it's time to start imposing at least some level of discipline onto the field and to kind of get over this crutch that's really an immature field, and we it's acceptable to do things that we know that really are not acceptable.
Yeah, well, no, I definitely hear what you're saying. You know, we know enough. As you said, some of these have been around for a very long time. It's probably a collective will issue, or maybe it takes some kind of a catalyst where you use concepts from other fields like the medical field to kind of raise awareness and attention. So let's say we had such a list, which would be a wonderful step forward. So if it could be developed and it could be agreed upon, as you said, there's many differing points of view, what do you think some of the implications might be, perhaps legal or warranty or other types of implications, if we had such a list that the community grabbed onto and began enforcing, even as a grassroots effort?
Well, I think that's a pretty interesting question. You know, as I mentioned earlier, the U.S. government and insurance companies, you know, have decided not to pay for certain, and as I said before, not all never medical never events. I think in many ways having a list like that is a pretty blunt instrument, but it has gotten the medical community's attention to pay attention to things that really shouldn't happen. One could argue, and I do, as I just said, that the software that contains some of the top 25 errors, really having that type of software is not acceptable anymore. And I think that if it's not being acceptable, if we agree that it's not acceptable, then why should anybody really pay for this, whether or not to be government or private contractors? At the same time, I think there's some who worry that this could open the door to, you know, a flood of litigation in the IT community and lead to a stifling innovation. You know, there are arguments, there have been arguments for as long as I can remember as well, about, you know, having mistakes is the price we have for progress in our field. And I think that, you know, there is some merit to that argument, but I think, again, as a community, we need to ask ourselves, what are our responsibilities when it comes to developing software with known preventable risks in them? You know, I think that a lot of the companies, even the members who were part of the top 25 error coalition, might blanch at being held, having their software held to a level where they might not get paid, or they might get held for consequential damages because of those errors. But I think, again, you know, we're at this point, I think, in the field that we really need to look at errors differently. And I don't think that we need to address all 25 at once. We can do something similar to what happened in the medical community, which started with a very small list, 3 or 5, and has slowly started to build that up. I think the real important thing is to get our conversation going in this area.
Well, we're certainly seeing some progress in specific market sectors like the payment card industry standards. Mm-hmm. You know, they've added some for application security, and the consequences of not acting or implementing those practices is that you don't get to hold cardholder data. So, you know, we're starting to see some limited application of the idea you're suggesting.
Well, I think that's true, and I think as we, again, as especially in the IT security area where the damages are getting greater all the time and they're becoming very visible, and we're getting to a point now where people are afraid to start getting onto the web. And when you get to a point where the risk outweighs the benefit, then I think we need to start putting in standards so that we can start to gain control again over our technology.
No, I think we've tolerated a certain level of, if you will, sloppiness and defects in the software that we use, and breaches and viruses, what have you. Do you think we're kind of at a point where that tolerance is dropping, and so there could be some momentum for this?
Oh, I think so. I think, again, let's go back in history, just in the last 30 years, and we've moved from a term that I'm quite sure a lot of people will be listening have absolutely no idea what I'm talking about when we talked about a closed shop, where in programming, where it sounds like a union shop, but in fact where the programmers were the primary users of the code that was developed. And as we've moved from what was that old term, closed shop, to open shops, where we had users, but they were, again, tended to be technically savvy users of software, and again internal to where we're at today, where, you know, Grandma and Aunt Millie uses the software, you know, on the web, and are demanded to use the web or computers to fill out forms or to check their bank statements, where you can't get instructions on a piece of product that you buy because you can only get it off the web. Then I think what's happened is we've moved to that level of social impact where Grandma isn't going to put up with this anymore. Either is Aunt Millie, neither should anyone. And so we as a community, which has been very technically focused and inward focused, and again, you know, we're very forgiving. My father-in-law and mother-in-law sister and brother-in-laws are not. If we want the technology to move forward and be used, then we have to pay attention to people who are going to be using it.
Well, when we last spoke, as we were getting ready to do today's podcast, you said you're planning to do some research in this area, perhaps write an article to get the idea out into kind of public conversation. So what are your plans for this work?
Well, right now I'm calling up lots of my I was almost going to say old friends, my longtime friends, like you, Julia, and asking their opinion about the idea. And I'm talking to everyone I can, from university researchers to practitioners, about the feasibility and the practicality of creating such a list, and whether or not, you know, the list that was created in the IT security space by top 25 error initiative, whether or not that's a good place to start. Could we use some of those errors on that list as de facto never events, or things that we should consider to be never events? And what I'm going to be doing is hopefully talking to as many people, pro and con, on the subject, and then hopefully have a major magazine story out by autumn of this year. And again, if somebody wants to has a strong opinion one way or the other, they should contact you to get a hold of me.
Well, that would be great. And, you know, because I just think that if we can get some momentum, a lot of things happen just out of planting an idea, letting it run, and see what happens with it. But before I let you go, as you know at CERT, we're doing a lot of work in the area of software assurance. We tend to focus heavily on software security, as you and I have been discussing, but assurance also involves software safety and software reliability. So do you think this concept could have traction in those disciplines as well?
Well, I think so. I think it can have traction in a lot of different areas of software development. You know, there are some similarities in safety and security, obviously. You know, you don't want to have race conditions in safety systems, and you don't want to have buffer overflows in those areas either. So there's a lot of cross-fertilization. I think, too, is one of the things that the medical community has done is also to take a look at process in terms of, are there ways in hospital quality of care that can be improved. For instance, in the hospital areas, they're using a lot of military checklist approach to try to make sure that surgeons don't operate on the wrong limb or take out the wrong organ or leave scalpels in patients after they sew them up. And so I think that just like what's happened in the medical community, I think that we can take a look even in areas of software development. You know, for instance, even simple things like ensuring that there are really good change control boards, so we actually know what's being changed in software from version to version, and that we don't allow patches to be put in. Those types of things, I think we can even detail out. There's a lot of knowledge that we've developed over the last 35, 40 years of software engineering and systems engineering that we ought to be able to codify, we ought to be able to make measurable, visible, repeatable, and say, if you don't follow at least some of these very, very basic practices, the software, if it turns out that there's an error and it can be traced back to that, then there should be some level of consequence for that.
Right, because on the IT security side, we'll sometimes call those minimum essential or security hygiene, you know, kind of like brushing your teeth and, you know, going for your physical once a year, kind of things like that.
Yeah, I don't think it's necessarily going to be easy either, because again, you know, there are, you know, there's a lot of different ways to you know, develop a system. But I think that there are some core practices that maybe as a community, as we start the conversation, we can all agree that this probably, or these approaches really should be ones that we all should follow, and it's our bad, as they say, if we don't.
So, Bob, while you're in the midst of your research and we're waiting for your article to get this ball rolling, do you have some places where our listeners can learn more about the idea?
Well, I think that at least if they want to take a look at the background of the idea, they can take a look at something like the National Quality Forum site, which describes medical never events and the history and how it came to be, and some of the arguments pro and con, which have application to software never events as well. I also think you could take a look, obviously, at the SANS Top 25 Most Dangerous Programming Errors. You can find that on the web, as well as the OWASP, which I'm
That's the Open Web Application
right.
Security Project, right?
Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome.
top 10 list. It's a group that's looked at web application security flaws. And then there's the Software Assurance Forum for Excellence in Code, or SafeCode, which is a vendor consortium made up of EMC, Juniper Networks, Microsoft, Nokia, SAP, and Symantec, which also have outlined a core set of security development practices that, that can be used in a lot of different development environments, all toward improving software security.
Well, I'm really thrilled to have an opportunity to talk with you about this. I know your efforts in risk management broadly are quite well known, and so kind of taking that laser focus and applying it to this issue, I think, can really help us move the conversation along. So thanks very much for your time today.
Well, thank you for talking with me.